Charles Bach is the author of the novels Alice and Oliver and Beautiful Children, which was a New York Times bestseller and notable book, and which won the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Charles was on the show with me back in 2008. A link to that podcast is up and available on our website. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in Harper's, the New York Times, the LA Times, and Slate, as well as in numerous anthologies. Charles is a graduate of the Bennington Writers Seminars. He lives with his wife, Leslie Jameson, and his daughter in New York City. Charles, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be back.
Well, I was saying before we went on the air, and I'll say it again for our listeners, that, you know, since 2008, when we last talked, there have been a lot of books and authors that have crossed my shelves. And you know, sadly, I can't keep all the books. So I really tried for a long time. I filled up an entire shower, in my husband's office, and he's like, enough with the books. But but Beautiful Children remains on my shelf. It has endured as one of my favorites, and ours was one of those interviews that remains fresh in my memory. So it's a huge pleasure to have you back on, and your second novel was absolutely worth the wait. So, and I know all that went into it. So really, welcome back.
Oh, you're so nice, Marie. Thank you so much. You can't ask for a nicer intro or a better compliment. You know, I get a lot of books as well, and it's true. Like, what you keep and what you have to thin out is like this is a constant, painful process.
It is. It's heartbreaking.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, we had to buy one of those little libraries that we put in front of our house so that at least I knew they were going to good homes. But
sure.
But not Beautiful Children. That one's staying. That one's staying in my
home. No, good. I'm so glad to hear it.
So because I think a good way to enter Alice and Oliver is to kind of talk about, because it tracks some real life events, is probably helpful to begin by catching up our listeners on what's happened since we last spoke in your life and how it led to the novel.
Sure. So Beautiful Children was published in early 2008. In December of that year, my wife, late wife, Diana Colbert, she gave birth to our daughter, our only child. About 6 months after that, I would say, so this takes us to early July of 2009, Diana was diagnosed with a complex form of leukemia. She had a couple of bone marrow transplants. She fought leukemia off and on. 3 days before our daughter's third birthday, Diana passed away. That's kind of the impetus, if there's a birth child. Alice and Oliver, which is the new novel, follows a young mother with a infant child. The mom is diagnosed with leukemia. Her name's Alice Colvert in the book. In the novel, she has one transplant, and it follows maybe about a year of her life. The novel also takes place in a different New York, New York of 1993, and also there's a fair amount of other things that are changed and that I worked with or did things differently on. But the spine and the genesis of the novel are rooted, you know, are definitely rooted in events that took place. Yeah.
It's interesting because I was talking with Chitra Divakaruni, was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about how in India, her grandfather had told her that people who survive best through tragedy are those who can create sort of a narrative out of the events, and that the act of storytelling and the act of making sense of what happened through story and through narrative arc, those people do better by processing tragedy. And I was wondering if you had any insights on that or if you thought that rang true.
I think in terms of processing, that it was very important for me as a person. I think that writing and trying to come to terms with something that you don't get over, but you have to learn how to live with. I think that writing was very important to me in that way. As the events were happening, that's a whole other question. I think we created a narrative at the time, because one of the things that the two of us decided on was that we didn't want to know statistics. We didn't want to know what, you know, a lot of things. We were only going to focus on what we had to do that day, or what things were happening that we had to take care of. And we were going to be very focused and have a very small circle for that, in terms of not letting ourselves get out of control or letting our minds run away with too much. Maybe that was our narrative. Maybe that's the sense of creating or controlling the narrative that's being referred to. We also, you know, a lot of it is living with huge amounts of uncertainty, and I think that it becomes its own pressure, but also its own art, because there's certain things you don't know what's going to happen, and you can't concern yourself with that. You can only concern yourself with that moment of, what do we have to do here?
Right.
I mean, that was my experience.
Yeah, the people that I've talked to that have gone through this, some of them very close to me, have said the exact same thing, that you really have to, they say your whole mindset sort of switches into this, what's the next hour look like and what's the next day look like?
Right.
And, you know, the new normal just becomes something totally different than it was yesterday, you know.
I think that's true, yeah.
I also wonder if
that was our experience.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to ask if you felt like entering into this as something you had just said a second ago, about entering into this as an artist, kind of gave some sort of, if any of that sort of helped in your perspective of looking at it, in finding the beautiful moments. I think artists and painters and writers are so wonderfully gifted at sort of recognizing the beauty in a moment, and, you know, kind of savoring the human, little human instances that you have between people. And I was wondering if any of that you thought came to bear to help during this.
I think that an appreciation for those moments allowed me to, made me aware that I was going to do a book, and allowed, along with whatever appreciation for just how hard it is and what goes on in this kind of situation, the beautiful moments that people still, that we still had, the moments of friendship, the moments where people rise, where people try their best or show themselves to, or connect in a certain way, the love of that between friends, between people who care for, between spouses, between even just good strangers who will be generous and try for each other, that made me, that saved me, that allowed me to survive. And that also, in those moments, I think seeing them and appreciating them, it really, I feel like it's the heart of the book, even though there's been, in the responses, a lot of responses to the book talk about that it's very unsentimental, and it is unsentimental about disease, but it's also unsentimental, I think, about in the pressure that's put on people and how the desire to live or to, for things to go well, can create a wildness in someone. But I think the heart of the book and the thing that makes it a special novel is the love that just exists for life and for friends and for loved ones. And my hope was that, I think, allowed me to write it, was that being really aware of those special moments and of just how precious what we have is, what each of us has in our life, even when it seems like it's fairly meager, there's still a fair amount that allows you to keep going.
Yeah, it was really heartening to hear how nicely the writing community rallied around. And you live in such a great writing community. I was out at One Story last summer and spent time in Park Slope. Yeah. And what a great community of writers and bookstores. And it was nice to see these people rallying. You know, I read some really heartfelt instances of people rallying around you.
Well, you know, it's, people were great. And the truth is, at least my truth has always been, that I'm busy writing, and most of the people I know or who I know of, they're busy writing, and we're all in our little cubbies or in our little office spaces or wherever we are, and you don't see each other that much. It's not, my experience is not that the community, like everyone gets together and there's the big writer softball game every weekend. But people, when they heard what was going on, people really showed up. And they were people I didn't know, or people that I had met and talked with once for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, or someone that I share an editor with, or my agent represents this person and he's heard that my wife is sick and says, what can I do? And I think that sense of community was huge. And it remains huge. And it's something that changed my opinion on a lot, because the easy thing is always, oh, is this person's book getting attention and my book's not getting attention, or they're in the New Yorker and I have a subscription to the New Yorker, you know, or however it works. But for things that really matter, my experience was that people were great, and they showed up, and they did what they could do, and I'll always be thankful for that. Yeah. I'll just always be so thankful for that.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that really struck me is how much more fiction can do than memoir in situations like this. And it seems like if you really had to adhere to every fact that happened to you, It feels like it probably would have held the story down, or even held some of the emotional truths of what you were going through down. And you know, being able to take advantage of the full range of what fiction can do seems like it might have opened this whole situation up.
Oh, I believe that completely. I couldn't agree more. I couldn't have said it better. To describe 2 bone marrow transplants over 2.5 years, and then coming out of remission and going back in, and just even saying that much to you, it's already brutal and mind-numbing. No one would read it. But fiction does allow for all kinds of possibilities and changing things and changing characters and adding some subplots, putting in a you know, bizarre and love triangle or love, the rectangle or whatever it is, those things add possibilities. Then just taking a scene and using your own mind where you can add things that you remember from being a teenager, something someone once said, and you can combine doctor visits and you can add jokes that you like, or it just makes so much more possible. And the hope is that you end up with a novel, or my hope was that I would end up with a novel that would stand on its own. And someone, yes, you could open it and think, it does say, and there's no way around, it's based on true events. But there's no way of knowing what, you can't go sentence by sentence and say what's real and what's not real. You can hopefully just appreciate the emotional power and the truth of the events on the page and of the characters who are on the page. And I do agree with you completely that fiction allows for more possibilities, and it hopefully makes for a bigger palette to be able to work with. Yeah, I never for a second thought of doing it as a memoir.
And it probably gives you more sort of emotional space to not have to dredge through every moment again. You know, it kind of frees you up.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I would think, yeah.
Absolutely, and then you can focus on certain things that you really want to communicate and build from them and do things from them. For example, Alice in the novel becomes very, very attached to certain ideas of Buddhism. And I was able to, you know, listening and reading things, listening to meditation tapes. I became friends with a writer who was himself a Buddhist monk, and I would ask him questions. And at some point, there was some question that I didn't understand or something that had been a dilemma. And he told me a story, and I was like, oh, right, right. And it opens up a different front and a different series of possibilities that then inform the novel. And it just made things more possible and more interesting. And I think that one thing that's true for any writer, whether they're at UC Irvine in their MFA program or they're listening to this at home and trying to figure out their first book, or they've published four books and are halfway through their fifth, you have to be entertained by what you're doing. And by entertained, I mean engaged. It has to be interesting and exciting to you. And I think for me, learning more and being able to draw on more things allowed my mind to play the game at a level where I was constantly engaged by it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. My guest this morning is Charles Bach. The book is Alice and Oliver. There's also a bunch of little details, and I don't know what's true and what's not, and it doesn't
sure.
matter, but there are so many great details that are resonant that I think fiction would also allow. Like, this couple lives in they live above a meat packing plant, which I think is this perfect
right.
backdrop for what they're going through, and this kind of surround of death and the smells and whatever
right.
goes into that is a great backdrop for this.
Well, and in the 90s, the meatpacking district in New York City did smell that way. And there were transvestite hookers and nightclubs, underground nightclubs and things like that all around it. And there was this biker bar, Hogs and Heifers. There was a place along with one other, a restaurant called Florent that was always open, that created a gentrification there. And over the next 10, 15, 20 years, changed the place entirely so that now the Highline District is there, and now it's a high-end shopping district, you know, and kind of, and there's galleries around there, but even they are now being kind of priced out. So, yes, on one level I was like, oh, the smell and the grittiness and the tactile, physical sense of what they're around is a great subject. And then also, with an eye down the road, there was this idea that all this is passing.
Yeah.
That even for the disease, as serious as it is, and these characters, that in a continuum, things change. Things are going to change. And so that gave me something down the road that I might be able to work with for the end of the book.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad. I feel like the 90s New York scene is a hugely entertaining part of the book. And so it's great for you to say that.
Totally. Yeah, when I read that, I was like, you can take the author out of Beautiful Children, but you can't take Beautiful Children.
Right, right.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, I guess so. That's true.
And I do think setting it in the 90s, you know, as I was thinking about this and thinking about New York and 9/11 and this sort of personal 9/11 that you've been through in your own life and this, you know, pre and post, I thought it also was interesting to set it pre 9/11 in this New York of, you know, certainly not an innocent New York, but a New York before that. And then, you know, your own sort of, you know, seismic experience to
right.
occur after that, and the epilogue after that, I thought was nice.
Oh, well, thank you. It's interesting because in 93, 94, someone did drive a car into, you know, filled, like there was a small level bombing the World Trade Center.
Yeah, right.
And even, it was even after it that Giuliani kind of decided, oh, I'm going to put the police's emergency response program in the Twin Towers just to show you can't mess with New York, which, just history would say that is, and experts at the time said this is a very bad idea, and history suggests it's a terrible idea. But, you know, that's what he did. And I struggled with, what do I put it in? Do I have some reference to that in the novel? There's also in 94, like Kurt Cobain put the shotgun, you know, ended his life. And do I put that in? Like, what things do I do there? And eventually I decided that the novel was what it was about, certain things. And I didn't want to make it be a 9/11 novel. And I didn't want to make it be that if I mentioned the Cobain stuff, I felt like that would take over too. That would require a certain amount of attention as well. So I picked a few things in terms of history and references that would resonate. But there were things that I 9/11 is such a major subject, and it deserves such a, if you do it, you really got to do it.
Right.
So my answer was, I'm going to run the other way. I got enough to do. I'm enough of a disaster here. And so I'll focus on that.
Yeah, yeah. And you also are so great at finding all the emotional and psychological notes on the keyboard. You know, it's sad, but it's also sexual, and it's also funny, and it's also tender. And there are, you know, all of these moments of real grace and joy. And so you really got to play with the full spectrum of emotion, which I'm sure is true in real life too.
I think you see things, and it is true, and it just is true. It's the full spectrum it's a hard thing. This illness is a serious illness on a family member or a loved one. It's especially someone who's in the prime of their life. I mean, we it's not less of a tragedy when elder people get seriously ill, but it's something that we know more of. The natural drama or the natural pathos and the natural just rock in a hard place, unfairness of a young mother with cancer, especially with a cancer that's very complicated and hard to put into remission, is hugely dramatic. And life still goes on, and every day life has to happen, and it brings with it all the bills and all the frustrations and all the arguments and all the tender moments of watching TV late at night. And I felt like if I could, that there was a book there and there was a great story there and a real love story, and that it did have all the marrow of with sexual desire, because sexual desire doesn't go away. And it would have humor, and ranging from very cute, funny jokes to some darker jokes. And I did feel like this is if I'm going to do it, if I'm going to try and write about this, if I'm going to try and do justice to what my wife went through, and also let my child know how much her mom wanted to be here, and, you know, start to have this long list of responsibilities. And one responsibility was, like, try and write this book up to what it could be. Like, don't shy away from the deep emotions and the tangled complexities of it. I've been lucky in that a lot of people have been affected by it and have felt that the novel is successful to some degree at these things.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. If not just an insight into our insurance quagmire in the United States. It's I mean, I think that's the answer to a lot of people's, oh my God, another cancer book, you know, that you,
right.
A friend of mine just got a rejection letter from an agent who said there are too many polio books. And I said, are there too many polio books?
Right. I mean, well, I'll tell you, I judged an award. I just judged an award for a series that where the entry had to do with medical conditions, and it was novels, memoirs, things about that. And it, you know, I'm not going to roll over or drop a dime on any of the people I judged with, but you do have conversations about, well, don't we have enough of these? And the truth is, at some point I looked on Amazon when I was writing this because I was worried, like, what are all the cancer novels? And there's characters who get cancer, but there's really not that many serious pieces of writing about, and certainly in fiction, and it's probably more true with nonfiction, about serious illness.
That's
that
right.
Take us through it all. There's how-to books, there's spiritual guides, there's homeopath and medical, you know, both medical and Western medicine and non-Western medicine ideas. There's lots of things, but there's just I don't know that there's that many really, truly excellent books about these things. And I think part of it is, how do you both do justice to very complicated medical things and then the human side? And since we live in America and we have to deal with, you know, our messed up government and our messed up systems, how do you deal with the insurance industry? Like, these were all parts of it. And I happened to have a lot of notes. I happened to have and my editor said, you have a seat for this. This is something, this is something you could really do. And for a long time, I thought I would be doing it with Diana, because the hope was that she would survive. And then when she didn't, then there was more responsibilities, because I wanted to both create a character who lived on her own, but who also inhabited a certain amount of Diana's spirit. So, the people who say, oh, we have too many of these, honestly, like with an agent or whatever, you can't do anything because they email you back and you're done with them. But you don't want that agent anyway.
Right.
That agent you don't want anyways. If you were at a cocktail party with the person, it's probably a good idea to say, yeah, you got a list? What are some of them?
Yep.
I spent however many years working on this, and I don't think there's any. I disagree.
Yeah, I have to say, I've never read anything like this. And, you know, sort of the, you're right, the sustained, you're right. There are a lot of characters who may have cancer in a book, but
yeah,
the sustained pressure on a marriage and you know, all of the permutations of this, I've never read anything like it before. And
I'm so glad to hear it. Humbly, without blowing my own horn, I haven't found any. I feel like one of the things that's interesting about me as a writer is I there's people where you could say, oh, it's a little like this, it's a little like that, but I kind of have my own drumbeat, you know. I do my own thing.
You really do. That's right.
Yeah. But I'm so glad to hear it. I really am. And it's a nice thing to say.
Yeah, it's all Charles Bach. Yeah, I mean, it really does feel like fiction is where we come to face our fears, and this is such a universal fear. And if it's not, you're just lying to yourself. This is the middle age, or even, you know, young age, getting cancer at a young age, fear. And
oh my God.
You know,
right?
Yeah. I mean, anytime I even go near a hospital, I get afraid, because they're just terrifying places. And I think fiction is where we go to turn our fears over in our minds and to test them and to play them all the way out to their conclusions and set them down when we need a break and come back to them when we need more. And I think this book will give so many people a template for not feeling so alone, you know, when they're faced with this.
Oh, thank you. That means so much to me. You know, I had never watched Game of Thrones. I know this seems like a ridiculous tangent, but it's going to come back to what you just said. I never watched it until very recently, where I started doing Netflix on it and catching up and all that. And you see people, and you see, you know, Khaleesi on her dragons, and you've got the red wedding, and you've got seriously intense stuff. You've got the villain, the little kid Joffrey, who's just the you know, like the worst character who's ever been on television, and where you have visceral reactions to them. We don't want to. There's things that are scary, and there's things that are dark, and popular culture lives and feasts on them. Whether it's 50 Shades of Grey, whether it's The Road, whether it's Homeland, whether it's Game of Thrones, there's huge amounts of darkness throughout our culture. We also live in a world where people say, I do not want to read a book if it's going to disturb me. And I do think that, I mean, I tried when I was writing this to write a great love story that also has a huge amount of suspense, that begins like a thriller, and the thriller question is, will she survive?
Yeah.
The villain is a villain that we're all way more scared of than a flying dragon.
Yep.
Because it is a true fear. And I think that true fear does affect people and make them say, look, I don't want to do this.
Yep.
But I also think that, is that a reason to not try and write a great book?
right.
Whether or not it is a great book, I don't know. But I think there's ways to try and say, yes, this is tremendously scary. This is the hard stuff. And yet in the hard stuff, there's still two people who are going to sit and make jokes in a waiting room. There's still two people who are going to laugh and who are going to disagree about things like, do we call the doctor again? Haven't you called the doctor too many times enough? Why do you bug? Well, do you want to go to the appointment and not have this information? You've called them 95 times. Why? What is number 96 going to do? Like, things that are just human.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I want to believe more, and I want to believe that someone who is... people who are going through this, hopefully this could be something that they could relate to and give them solace and not make them feel alone.
Yeah.
But also people who want to understand our world, or who want to read a great love story, or just want to read a really good book, that a really good book can go, like you said, to the deepest, weirdest places and say, you're not alone in these places.
Yeah.
That is one of the hopes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was so effective on all those levels. Cause I found myself at certain times, you know, jealous of Alice and Oliver's marriage. I just thought they had such a neat marriage, and thank God she had him. And, you know, I mean, it's, even within this, even within all of this sorrow, there were so many highs for this couple who were so clearly in love. And it was just a really tender, wonderful love story.
Oh, thank you. And I thank you. I appreciate that, because I wanted to push it. What is love? What do we owe each other? What do we owe ourselves? Because I felt like Alice certainly faces that. And Oliver, in his own way, even as he's taking care of her and doing everything he can for her, he also has to face that question, you know, that selfish me question of, what about my needs? And what about me as a human being? And what about, you know, my business, and et cetera, et cetera? And that those are questions we all face. And in this case, I did want the string to be able to run through to the end. And for everyone to come through and say, oh, it is a lovely. This is a good marriage. It's not an unrealistic one, but it is a special relationship.
Yeah. Before we get into all the annoying craft questions that I plague authors with, but I wanted to know if the experience—I know the experience changed you, but how it impacted your art and your writing and your voice, and if you think your fiction in the future has a different mission than you thought it had in 2008, or if you look at writing in a different way and its meaning in a different way after this.
That's a really good question. I wish I had a better answer. I wish I had a good answer. Like now I'm I think I'm changed because I went through it, and that I'm a much more, and I think also as most of us get older, we become, and especially if you're older and you have a child, you become just a lot more easily emotional and much more aware of the specialness of the world.
Boy, that
probably
is true.
in my 20s, I think part of being a 20s, especially if you're a guy, is you have to have a pose of jadedness about the world. You have to have that. And as you get older, you kind of realize, yeah, it is corrupt. Yeah, everything is kind of messed up. But look at what isn't. Look at what isn't. And I'm figuring out, you know, I'm still figuring out what I'm doing next. I have a couple of different projects that I'm playing with. I'm very curious to see what happens next. Part of me just wants to write something really entertaining that does not have, you know, the lightning bolts of seriosity and the gravity of it all. But then, as soon as I say that, I think, well, entertaining how? Entertaining is lightweight, or entertaining is something that's just really great to read. And what makes it great, or what makes it really entertaining? And so I don't know. I don't know what I'm gonna be. I know I don't have the energy I had when I was writing Beautiful Children. That's for sure. But I also don't think that I'm as wild either, and I think that there's something beautiful about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's neat to see an author over the decades, and you can see where they were, you know, at each stage of their life, and their writing maturing with them and taking on kind of their worldview. It's really it's really special.
I think it is. Yeah, I totally agree. And in fact, it's less interesting when they're doing the same stuff.
Exactly.
Over huge amounts of time, it gets.
Exactly. Do you have recommendations for people who are going through this of what you found that was helpful, or what you would have done differently, or anything? Living through illness, kind of things that sustained you. I know that you took a lot of notes through that and made a lot of observations. And I was thinking, as a writer, that actually would be helpful to get some of this stuff out of your brain and you know, into a notebook. But I don't know if there were other things that sort of helped you out.
Well, I stopped, you know, one thing that I did that I think was helpful for me, I stopped trying to write. I took notes, but I took notes while I was taking, you know, of an observation or a funny joke here or there, or something I noticed while I was taking notes about what stuff I have to go get at the pharmacy. My focus was on trying to make sure my wife was okay.
Yeah.
I think if anyone is going through this with a loved one, like, you know what's important. Try and deal with what you have to deal with. When all the other stuff, there are websites like Helping Hands. There are friends, there are relatives, there are people where you can set up some kind of system and to try and help. But like, try and take care of the people who you care for. And then the finance, you know, and also in the not, and as far as the financial stuff, in the novel, there's a whole chapter of conversations where the husband, Oliver, talks with a health insurance lawyer who gives little tips about how to deal with your insurance company over the phone and what to do about bills and what to do about financial aid. And I would say, you know, go buy the book or go check the book out from the library and photocopy that chapter.
Yep. I flagged that. You know, I flagged that chapter. Yes, I do know. Yeah, that was incredibly helpful. Yeah,
because I didn't know any of that stuff, and then I had to have someone did tell me all that, and then I told me more than that. But I used certain things and tried to figure out how do I fictionalize this, and now how do I teach someone this because they're going to need to know it.
Yeah,
and I made Oliver be the kind of person who, like the rest of us, doesn't like hospitals and doesn't know this stuff and is more than eager to yell at someone on the other end of the phone, you know, towards the animated phone drone, and finds out that you can't do that stuff, that you can't. I think anyone who is going through something like this or who has a loved one going through something like this needs a system around them. They probably need a therapist, and they also need to, along with that, to be very connected to the person who they care about.
Yeah, right.
You know, I don't think that chasing after stuff that isn't important helps anyone like this. Like, yeah, it was a real circle the wagons type time.
Yeah. Just a few questions on craft. Do you still
yes.
have a couple minutes?
Yes.
You're being so generous with your time, but I could drown in your conversation.
I am having the best time. Don't you even think twice.
This is so wonderful. So I wanted to talk a little bit about characters who gave you trouble. Alice is not Diana,
and
you are not Oliver. And so tell me a little bit about characters who may have pushed back against you or characters who you had trouble accessing and, you know, kind of getting away from the reality and making these people full-fledged, you know, human beings in their own relationship on their own.
Well, it's interesting because Alice was somewhat a little easier for me because I knew it couldn't be Diana. I knew there were things I wanted her to have. But I also pretty early decided make her kind of fashion-y. And I've loved Truman Capote is one of the writers. It sounds ridiculous, but he's one of the writers who made me sure that I wanted to write fiction. I just love how pretty his paragraphs are, how beautiful his sentences are. And I got in my head that I was going to superimpose a kind of Holly Golightly voice on this woman. And that led to kind of making her a hanger-on or a freelancer in the fashion world, not someone who has her own line or someone who's a paid employee making lots of dresses, but someone who gets employed or bought or who comes in and helps finish things on deadline. And someone who works at, you know, Fashion Week to sew people into dresses. But, and doing that, helped me find and helped me build a voice for her that pretty quickly I understood who she was.
God, that's great. That's great.
Oliver, I tried to make him be a rich guy. In an early draft of the book, I thought it would be better if he kind of was living and running his little software company with trust fund money. And two people who read the first draft of the book both said to me, he doesn't act in any way like someone who has money. He's too combative, that he's just combative, and people who have money are used to just paying bills.
Right,
you know? And so I had to go through and think about him again and then build him up from the ground a second time. And I think I had more problems with him. I had more problems kind of understanding him than I did with Alice. Yeah.
You know what I liked about his job as a computer coder is that it made fictional sense to me to have this sort of genetic coder, this rewriter of scripts to make something work. And there is some point in the novel where he talks about this job is like moving an entire body of water into an entire other body of water. And you have to do it in the same order. And I thought, you know, cancer and genetics is something similar. Something in the code gets messed up. And you have to rewrite the code to make it work out again. And I thought, you know, another lovely thing you can do in fiction that is not true in real life, that, that these things really resonate whether the reader is aware of it or not.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I don't know that until you said that, I wasn't aware of that. I'm sure of it. But that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true that those that's the case. Yeah.
It's even...
I wanted someone who would be exact. A person who, like, has this logical mind, is exact, so that when it's time to, like, take care of details, he would be on top of it, but he would also be the type of person who drives everyone around him nuts.
Yes. Right. Right.
Yeah.
There's even a lovely section in here, and I don't know if it's true or not, where Alice is blind, or she has some difficulty with her eyes for a while. And too is a lovely metaphor, I think, of, you know, blindness to what's going on, not wanting to see what's going on. You know, I just think there are so many really great resonances, metaphoric resonances that worked so well throughout. And these really wonderful...
I'm so glad.
Yeah, no, it was...
Thank you.
Masterful, really masterful. And the case studies, I thought, also were a really nice. So the book, for people who haven't read it, is sort of peppered with these other cancer case studies throughout that kind of give us room to breathe or introduce us to other characters that we wouldn't
know. Yeah, they definitely give room to breathe. And originally I thought they would be commercials. And I was constantly trying to figure out how do I connect them to make them actually belong in the book. And I ended up with a way that I think is really creative and interesting and also doesn't turn it into a giant 1,000-page book with 59 characters who we can't follow. So I've been proud of that. And I also feel like that they're entertaining and then they have their own momentum and then they progressively reflect the mood of how things are going or go against the mood of how things are going. Yeah, I was very happy with them.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're really wonderful. And just not having chapter numbers, I think, was really nice too. So you have kind of chapter titles. But it gave the sense of uncertainty and disorder. Like we kind of don't know where we are.
Right.
It's broken up into sections, but I thought that really lent itself well to the story structure too.
Oh, thank you. That's something where it does ask a reader to pay a little attention, but I wanted that floating dislocation. And the truth is the first chapter, does have little titles on each chapter title. And the second actually takes away some of the titles. And so there's less. And then the last major chapter, which is told in Alice's voice, there's white space between each section, but there's no page breaks and there's no headers at all.
Yeah.
So there's an idea that it's all melding together, that everything is kind of merging together. And it was a decision to try and use little organizational things like chapter numbers or chapter titles or page breaks and to gradually take them away. That was something I wanted to try and do. And I know that there might be a little sense of dislocation from a reader, but the hope is that it pulls them deeper into the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Super, super smart. Ah, God, what a great book. Are there things we should have talked about that we didn't, or advice that you like to give writers that we haven't covered yet?
I'll tell you, for the advice that I really have for writers is to give yourself the time to get things right, to not to rush yourself, to not try and be published before you're good, to not take a cake out of an oven before it's fully cooked, And I know exhaustion is a huge deal. And I understand that wanting success or wanting to be published or wanting it to be over is a huge deal. But the truth is that the best advice there is you're going to get humiliated. You're going to try, and you're going to have doors shut in your face, and you're going to have people saying no, and you keep trying, and they say no again, and they humiliate you more, and you think you can't be humiliated more, and they find new and creative and exciting ways to shut doors in your face and make new doors. And if you keep at it and you pay attention to your sentences and your structure and you learn and work and do the work, eventually you write something good. Hmm. And when you write something good, people want it. Not everyone. There's always going to be some unhappy, intellectually dishonest person who writes a review, who doesn't like you, you don't know why, or who doesn't like some reason they have a bug up their rear that you don't know. Not everyone is going to get your groove. But if you stay at it and you do things and you learn and you write something good, doors open, because people need good stories. People need good books. That's the best advice anyone ever gave me, and it's the thing that I truly believe.
And it's so true. Yeah, it's so true. This book is going to stay long on my shelf next door to Beautiful Children. It was really, really a pleasure. Charles Bach, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Marie. You're amazing. Thank you. This was just great. Hopefully it won't take me so long before the next one.
Well, I'll be right here waiting. Don't worry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.